G'day mate, how you going? This is Adam O'Brien and welcome to Fandom Podcast Network, here where we enjoy all forms of fandom. Well, coming to you live from Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia, I bring you Lethal Mullet Podcast, an Australian look at B-grade action films from the 1980s. That's right, going back to that beloved time when we had Chuck Norris on almost every Friday night here in Australia, kicking, punching, and shooting his way to the top, alongside Jean-Claude Van Damme, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the likes of many of the others that came after him, Sylvester Stallone. We even look at some of the heroes you may not know, all here on one Fortnite with Podcasts here on the Fandom Podcast Network. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can check it out also on Podbean if you've got the Podbean app. Make sure you check it out. Now, let's get into the episode here on Fandom Podcast Network. G'day, mate. How you going? This is Adam O'Brien for Lethal Mullet Podcast, coming to you live from Quinlan's Cantina on the Gold Coast of Australia, live here on Fandom Podcast Network. And I tell you what, we've got a 30-minute solid episode here looking at all 80s action cinema just for you. Of course, if you loved all those films from 1980 all the way through to 1989, well, we've got quite a bit coming up in the next couple episodes which you can really enjoy. One of the things we're going to be chatting about tonight is, of course, John Carpenter again. And, of course, we're going to have some dear friends on the next couple episodes talking about their love of some of the Carpenter classics, whether it is They Live, whether it is like the last episode with Blair, we had him on to chat about his love of some of the greats. Of course, Big Trouble in Little China happens to be one of those big ones. But I'm somebody that likes science fiction, going to, you know, the likes of The Thing, and, of course, even some of the horror-based ones even further from that too. I think The Thing is one of the absolute classics, though, when it comes especially from the mind of John Carpenter. So we're going to be looking at some of that tonight, and we're going to be talking about some upcoming events here on the actual podcast channel itself. Of course, right now you can catch me not only here, but you can catch me on Couch Potato Theatre's The Spicing Guild Part 2, which will be going out in the next week. And that covers, of course, Frank Herbert's Dune miniseries that was on the Sci-Fi channel. And of course, that's probably the best adaptation currently of what's out there when it comes to Frank Herbert's amazing space opera. Now, that is one that's going to be having myself and, of course, Kyle Wagner, one of the co-directors of this amazing channel, and we really get into what it is about the adaptation that works for us. Of course, it starred William Hurt, and it's one of those real, I personally think, groundbreakers for the time. I mean, looking back on it now, production-wise, probably doesn't hold up quite as well, but story-wise, they really knocked it out of the park, and of course, it's how Dune should be told. And of course, we talk a little bit about Denis Villeneuve's new adaptation he's currently working on. There's been at least 5 to 6 castings already for some of the characters. We're going to look at our thoughts on what it should be like. And of course, is this going to be a success? You know, it's two parts they're making. They're making the first film right now. So it's interesting to see just where that's going to go. And of course, if you know me, you know Dune is one of the biggest things in my life. I just love it. So we'll be talking about that and much, much more all here on the podcast channel itself. But before we can get into that, let's have a look at where you can find all the great shows and, of course, contact us here at the one, the only Lethal Mullet Podcast. Here we go. All right, before we get into the episode tonight, here's where you can catch this show and many others like it on Fandom Podcast Network at fpnet.podbean.com, which is our main master feed. You also catch the actual show itself on the Podbean app. It's one of the greatest ways to check out the show. Also, if you like all the shows, you can catch them at all these different places where you can catch podcasts on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, and, of course, Google Play if you're an Android user. Now, also, on social media channels, you can find us on Twitter at FanPodNetwork, and on Facebook, you can catch us at Fandom Podcast Network's page there at facebook.com/
Fandom Podcast Network. If you want to catch us on the email lines, email any ideas you have that the show might be able to cover, any other films you think that have been fantastic, you can catch us at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. You can catch me, the host, Adam O'Brien, at obpopculture on Twitter and, of course, on Instagram as well, same handle. And don't forget to catch me on my other show, The Fantha from Down Under, a fortnightly look at Star Wars from Down Under on Fantha Tracks Radio or FanthaTracks.com. And also check out the great shows that I'm doing here on Phantom Podcast Network's Couch Potato Theatre, where we look at Mad Max with Maximum Couch Potato, and also our brand new show, The Spicing Guild, looking at the adaptations of Frank Herbert's Dune. Now, let's get into the show. One of the things that the 1980s is probably best known for in terms of action film is, of course, the many different types of martial arts cinema that we got, and of course the different eras. And I think one of the great things is VHS really, I think, made a clear path when it came to all these different types of action films, and of course the different heroes that we found along the way. One of the more interesting ones I've been watching lately, and I've been looking at some of the great interviews online, you can find them on YouTube, for example, is, of course, the amazing action star we all know as Shoko Sugi. Probably best known for his ninja films, and of course, you know, he really represented, I think, ninja cinema in the 1980s for classics like, of course, Enter the Ninja, Pray for Death, Nine Deaths of the Ninja, Ninja 3, and of course, this is kind of, I suppose, a trilogy that he made with Canon Films. He had Enter the Ninja, Revenge of the Ninja, which I think is probably the greatest. And if you get the current edition you can get, which is, I think, a double disc, if I remember right, of in a Blu-ray pack from Canon Pictures Films, of course. And that is, of course, Revenge of the Ninja and Enter the Ninja, back-to-back. I mean, just you get double the Kasugi when it comes to it. But you know, here he is, 6'1", amazing build when it comes to strength and athleticism. He really represented, I think, the peak of martial arts and physicality in the day. But the films itself, too, were really inspirational for a lot of people. A lot of people got right into martial arts at the time. And as you can see in some of these film clips you can find, whether it's on YouTube or whether you get the DVDs of behind the scenes of Sho himself chatting about these days and how he got into film, it's really interesting. And of course, you know, it started from, you know, whether it's his love of, you know, keeping fit or doing martial arts and learning about all these different abilities that you can have from doing such huge you know, styles, you know, that will obviously become part of your life down the line. But let's look at the martial arts side of it. When it comes down to it, Franco Nero's leading this film that really set Sho on his path to be a star. And of course, that is Enter the Ninja. And of course, it's probably the first one that I really got to see as a youngster. I think it was only about 9 or 10 years old. We had that playing on a very late night. I think it was 11 p.m. or something like that out in Australia. And of course, we're sitting down there watching this thing, and I get to see the white versus the black ninja, and straight away it's cut down the line. You know who the good guy is and who the bad guy is, and of course the array of different weaponry we see, and of course they're in the Philippines, and you really get to see, I think personally, for what it is, it is a fantastic little action film. And then a few years later, I got to see, I think it was in my early teens, got to finally see Revenge of the Ninja, which was hard to find at the time. You could actually find Ninja 3 more than you could find the others. I think it was called Ninja 3 The Domination, which was fantastic. And I really enjoyed that one because, again, it's a different take on the ninja story as well. And, of course, we got to see Sho step out from that as well. And he'd had done a film called Black Eagle as well with Jean-Claude Van Damme in the Middle East as well, where, of course, it was, I suppose, a little bit more spy-like in a way. And again, you really got to see, you know, a karate professional like himself and, of course, The Muscles from Brussels go toe-to-toe. Again, great to always see, back in the day, these two dominant action superstars going up against each other. And I don't think you've seen anything like that until really the Expendables or thereabouts. So it was great to see that. And this is, of course, the start of Van Damme's career as well, where he just stepped out from doing, I think it was No Retreat, No Surrender. He's played the villain in that, and then played, I think about the same time, the villain in Black Eagle. Of course, Sho went on to do quite a few other things. He did what was known out here in Australia as Shogun Maeda, which was basically a samurai story of a samurai and his disciple going all the way to, I think it was Spain, if I remember right. I haven't seen the film for about 20 years. But again, this was another one that was a highlight because you got to see the different clashing of styles or fighting styles of the classical Renaissance and fencing versus, of course, kenjutsu or sword fighting too. So it's always entertaining, always fascinating. And I think the one thing that we got from Kosugi was the amazing amount of culture as well, along with the martial arts. And, of course, just great stories and great acting. I love him. I think he's fantastic. And at the end of the day, we will always celebrate his work in action cinema.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. We'd like to recommend these other great podcasts on the Fandom Podcast Network. It starts with our flagship show, Culture Clash, our weekly pop culture podcast with the latest news, reviews, and other fun topics in pop culture. Also, Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast where we discuss all things Highlander. Couch Potato Theater, our podcast celebrating the cult classic and fan favorite movies we don't get off the couch for. Time Warp, a look back on our classic and nostalgic fandoms that we still celebrate today. The End Zone, our podcast talking about all things current in the NFL and giving our best mediocre fantasy football advice. Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. Discoville, a Star Trek Discovery and the Orville podcast. The Hair Metal Podcast, if you're a hard rock music fan, the Hair Metal Podcast rediscovers the nostalgia of the 1980s hair metal bands. And Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, as we discuss all things Doctor Who, past and present. You can find these great shows on the Fandom Podcast Master Feed at fpnet.podbean.com. The Fandom Podcast Network is on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play. On Facebook, you can find us at Fandom Podcast Network. On Instagram, we are at Fandom Podcast Network. And on Twitter, at FanPod Network. You can also email us directly at FandomPodcastNetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening and support the Fandom Podcast Network. And remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.
All right, now to the main part of the show tonight. We're going to be looking at my love of The Thing. Now, we're going to have, obviously, many different people come on as guests on this show and chat about their love of John Carpenter. But what I want to do is really spend this episode in telling what I love about The Thing. It is my favorite of his films. And I think, especially out of the ones he worked on with Kurt Russell, this is probably my absolute favorite. Again, because it's not playing into just that entertainment factor. You know, he really made this film with, I mean, you know, it's a story that's been told before, but I think he really had something to say here, and it still plays on your mind about the story and where it ends up. And of course, you know, is the thing still there? Is the thing Kurt Russell, or is it Keith David's Charles? You know, if it's RJ McCready, well, I mean, there's a whole other story there about to happen. Or is it Charles? I mean, it really is one of those great tales. And me, as somebody that, hasn't grown up around snow too, I think the captivating thing for me was the environment. Even though my family is from Tasmania and it is the coldest place in Australia, we've lived in the Queensland area for much of my life. So again, that's just goes with the territory. But let's look at the film itself. You know, this is, again, a retelling of The Thing from Outer Space, basically. It is one that we all know has been done before to a certain extent, but it's the way that it's done with the alien that makes it not only scary, but makes it thrilling at the same time. And the effects work on this film is some of the best done in the 1980s. I mean, by far. I mean, this is huge. So it's directed by John Carpenter, produced by David Foster and Lawrence Terman, and of course based on the screenplay done by Bill Lancaster. But it's based on Who Goes There, written by the one, the only John W. Campbell Jr. So you know you're in sci-fi heaven there. Of course, starring Kurt Russell, one of many, and of course, music by Ennio Morricone. So if you've got Morricone doing a score for you, you're pretty much set. I mean, it's just one of those things. Now, the film itself obviously released in 1982 alongside some of the great classics. Of course, E.T. pretty much cleaned up that year. But of course, 82 also gave us my number one favorite film of all time. Of course, it's Ridley Scott's Blade Runner. And we'll have a little bit more on Blade Runner upcoming episode, where I'm going to be reviewing the brand new Blade Runner Nexus mobile game. If you're not addicted now, well, you will be soon, I tell you what. But anyway, we're here to talk about The Thing, not Blade Runner, so we'll get on to that soon. Of course, the film is set in Antarctica and, of course, starts media res straight in when we see the Norwegian helicopter pursuing a dog. That's right, a sled dog. And one of the things that you got to think about too in this is that even though, of course, we got the prequel many years later, and actually it's a pretty good prequel too. If you haven't watched it already, it really is one that I think you should watch before you watch The Thing. If you haven't seen either of them before, it works really well together. And they're very clever how they sort of looked at what was done in the Carpenter film and gave us the story, undoing a lot of those plot elements to figure out how to build this story up. I mean, really, really, I think, drove what was could have been a pretty ordinary prequel into something that was exciting. And, of course, putting those two together, I think even works better than the Star Wars prequels versus the classic trilogy. It really does. but, of course, the main plot of this film is all about the Norwegians letting loose this thing that basically comes to pass, that it will infect people around it and becomes them. So that's the one thing, is that idea that the thing can basically become you or become anything around it, anything living, vital, and again, makes it so scary. And of course, the film, is one that had been, or the book itself had been done, or the story itself by, I think was it the thing from Another World, which was, I suppose, same story, but I think you look at it, it had been done by Carpenter. Carpenter's done it far more successfully than anybody else. And I think the environment and the way this was filmed with Russell, of course, and the team, it really just made for something that was so exciting. So the film itself really represents, I think, from a cold perspective, Antarctica, it's interesting that they choose such a chilling environment when you're doing a horror film. It's going to be chilling, see? So I love that that's sort of part of what this film's but it's the setting itself drags you in that way. But also you're kicking and screaming as you're dragged along with the story. It just doesn't stop. And there's slow points here and there, but one of the great things about this film is you're finding out about things as the characters do, which is one of the greatest parts of storytelling. But the main thrust of the story, without giving away the story to all those out there, obviously the Americans in this, led by, of course, R.J. McCready, the helicopter pilot, played by the one, the only, Kurt Russell, and the doctor, basically, after having the Norwegians come get shot, they have to basically go out, find out what happened in the Norwegian camp. Hence why I said before, go and check out the prequel, because you actually find out, but also just how they actually figured out how to lay all that out as R.J. McCready and the Doctor saw it in the film. But obviously the actual organism itself that and got in there and did all the damage has come back. And, of course, this alien form that we see starts to wreak havoc inside the camp. And, of course, leads to some of the most greatest horror from 1982. But I have to say, again, the film, no matter how many times I watch it in the story, it still feels fresh and vital, no matter what happens. You know, it's, I suppose, a little bit like James Cameron's Aliens, even more so than Ridley Scott's Alien. It's just the way the film was laid out is just one of those great all-time favourites of mine. So, again, Carpenter was, you know, no stranger to putting together this kind of film. And I think, again, the partnership he has with Russell doing these films is so strong. They work together, you know, like chalk and cheese. And it really, really works. You know, they've got their own styles. But, again, they're friends that know what their strengths are and really play to it. So let's look at some of the cast itself. I think this is one of the more interesting things. So we have, obviously, Wilfred Brimley playing Blair. We have T.K. Carter playing Knowles. We have Keith David playing Charles, probably my favourite in the show itself. We have Richard Dysart playing Dr. Copper, Charles Hallahan playing Norris. See, you get a bit of Norris in this one. Ain't Chuck, though. Thomas Waits playing Windows. And we have Donald Moffat playing Gary. Richard Mauser, of course, playing playing Clark. And again, you know all these actors from different productions too that are out there. So one of the great things too in this is the, you know, of course the story just can go any way that you like it. You know, you've got, you know, something that's been told before. And I suppose in a way it's kind of like Escape from New York in a certain way. It's a story that's told around the character, like R.J. McCready is not like a Snake Plissken, but they're kind of, I suppose, in some ways, anti-heroes in this world, you know. In this case, McCready just wants to get the job done no matter what happens. It's always interesting. But one of the great things, too, is the way the cast, I think, it almost feels like this group's been together forever. You know, some casts you see in films don't gel, you know, or they feel stilted, and it might be even the way a film is directed, but this is very loosely feels like it's a team that's been together for a while. They know each other so well, you know, it's almost like they finish each other's sentences, and that's how it would be in that environment, especially out in the Antarctic too. So, but it's interesting, you know. Again, you got Russell with his beard and the hair, which, according to what I've researched, says that it took him almost a year to grow the look for it. And it looks like the names like Brian Dennehy, John Hurt, Ed Harris, even Tom Berenger, and Aussie Jack Thompson, my egg-yown, were all up for it as well for the role. But again, the idea came back that, you know, he got to playing the actual movie itself again. Filming itself is one of the interesting things is it was done, principal photography itself, near Juneau in Alaska. So, again, an interesting part, Alaska. I mean, it's one of those things Carl Wagner knows quite well. You know, you have to fly so far to get anywhere. And, of course, you can't just drive from one place to another. So, again, it would have been logistically one of those tough ones. But it looks like the film itself took place in 1981 and lasted almost, by the looks of it, about 3 months, so about 12 weeks. And, of course, they had work they had to do on the Universal lot as well. And, of course, you look at the difference, you know, you got a more controlled environment if you do in the studio compared to going out in the elements, anything can happen. So it's interesting, you know, and, of course, then they also had certain outdoor shots they had to do in Stewart, British Columbia as well. So interesting that way. And, of course, for me, I got to see a lot of this extended behind the scenes and stuff, and not until I got the actual Blu-ray of the thing. You get to see some of the stuff that they did on location and stuff like that out too. So it's interesting. Again, they've got to make sets out in these locations, and like anything, you know, it drives much more of the reality in a lot of these films when you see it like that, compared to, as we talk about on the Spicing Guild podcast, a set environment they've done for Arrakis, where you can actually see Vittorio Storaro putting up these huge tapestries behind the sets, which may not have been evident on the old analog TVs and, of course, on the VHS. But these days, you just don't have that. You have HD, which sees everything, which is very, very interesting at the end of the day, too. So one of the big things, the creature effects for this film, is what people come back forward to, you know, and the thing itself, assimilating itself into different forms, is what we're known for. And of course, Rob Bottin, of course, famous for his effects on this film and, of course, many of the others in the 1980s. And, of course, Bottin is an interesting figure because he kind of left the effects world at the turn of, I suppose, the event of CGI coming in. And it's interesting because he really was one of those effects gods at the time who were coming in, making these amazing creatures and different special effects that go along with it. And in some ways, you know, just seeing what his mind would create is some of the great parts of whether it's this film or many of the others that you've seen his work run through. And of course, he's the one that came up with a lot of the ideas of how the thing would operate. And we see the different designs of the legs of creatures and stuff like that, different forms as it imitates what it's going to kill. And, you know, even to this day, you watch that now, it's better than any CGI is going to give you. And I think even they took that into, obviously, Rob didn't work on the prequel, but Bottin's work is such a heavy influence. You can see it in some of the, you know, on-camera effects that you see coming through on the next one. It's gorgeous, and it really holds up in that path too. So, I mean, it really is not just an action film, not just a thriller, not just a horror film. It's an effects film and probably one of the most successful of the early 1980s films. In particular, I think it's probably Carpenter's strongest when it comes to mixing those with live action work, with a lot of the, whether it's stop motion or different effects they're doing in front of the camera. You know, that film really tricks your eye like nothing else has done before and will never do again. CGI just doesn't have that volume, no matter what you put on it. You can look at things different ways and really try and see where, you know, the mind of the creator is coming from. But CGI, still to this day, for me, hasn't tricked the eye like Robert Teen has on this. And I think, you know, you got to hand it to the way it was shot. And at the end of the day, also the way that, you know, Jean came up with these concepts, just fantastic. So compared to the other films, I think, you know, The Thing stands apart for me. It is number one. Escape from New York's probably a close second. And out of the others, you know, I put They Live in particular. I think, you know, you look at They Live and probably Big Trouble on the same path as far as levels of fun and stuff. And it's interesting that there's been talk of a They Live sequel. Now, how do you have a sequel when all the characters die? Oh, shock, spoiler. But I'm sorry, it's not 1986 anymore. but that's true. You know, all the characters met an end in that one. So, you know, where do you take it from here, you know, at the end of the day? But the one thing that you can continue with is the fact that the actual story itself continues for the aliens themselves, these interdimensional beings or whatever they are. They're still here. They're still making you obey as a human race when it comes to in within that universe. So again, we need another rebellion. We need somebody out there. Maybe The Rock can come in and being in this one. It's, you know, whether it's this one or the long-mooted film of the Big Trouble in Little China sequel that we keep hearing about too. So I want to hear what your thoughts are about this too. So definitely let us know here at Lethal Muller Podcast what your favorite of the John Carpenter films are. You know, which John Carpenter film is the one that you go, hey, that's the one I could watch anytime. You know, let us know, whether it's here or on the social channels at Obi Pop Culture on Twitter, vice versa, what you love about John Carpenter films.
Welcome to My Saga, a Star Wars fan podcast. Each week, we'll bring you stories of how Star Wars impacted so many fans from around the globe, along with Star Wars news, reviews, and discussions.
We would be honored if Come on.
So grab a Scarif Soda, deploy the garrison, put your feet up, and join us here today at the My Saga Podcast.
The Fanta.
Land me up, Fuzzball.
From Down Under.
Do. Or do not. There is no try.
G'day, mate. How you going?
Welcome to Fandom Podcast Network's Couch Potato Theatre. This is Maximum Couch Potato, a special look at the Mad Max franchise, the Australian wasteland fantasy epic series, with of course the iconic character, the one, the only, Mad Max. We've looked at Mad Max, the 1979 epic, starring of course Mel Gibson as the wandering Main Force Patrol officer, who of course exacts revenge the death of his family. Then, of course, we looked at the amazing Western-themed The Road Warrior, known out in Australia as Mad Max 2. And now we look at Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. I'm your host, Adam O'Brien, and joining me is the co-founders of this amazing channel, Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel and Kyle Wagner, here to chat Mad Max.
Here's where you can find all the great shows on Fandom Podcast Network. You can go to podbean.com, where we are at fpnet.podbean.com. That's a great way to check out the show, or even download the Podbean app off iTunes or maybe Google Play. Fandom Podcast Network on social channels. You can also find us on Twitter on the handle at fanpodnetwork. You can also catch us at Facebook on facebook.com/fandompodcastnetwork. You can show all the shows on your iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, or Google Play for Android users. If you'd like to contact us directly, you can find us on email at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. You can catch me, the host of the show, here at obpopculture on both Twitter and Instagram. To get your own Fandom Podcast Network t-shirts and other apparel, please visit Fandom Podcast Network store on TeePublic. On iTunes, please leave us a review on iTunes so new fans can find us easier. We love 5-star reviews, of course, but we love general feedback. Please listen to our other podcasts on the Fandom Podcast Network master feed at fbnet.podbean.com. Check out Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast. You also catch Culture Clash, the weekly pop culture show. We also have Couch Potato Theatre, the guilty pleasure favourites. We also have Time Warp, the Fandom Flashback podcast. If you're into American football, why not check out The End Zone with Kyle Wagner and, of course, Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel. We also have, if you're an Alfred Hitchcock fan, The Good Evening Show. If you're into Star Trek Discovery and, of course, The Orville, you can catch us at Discoville. Also, if you're into Poison, Guns N' Roses, and, as Kevin's brought up, LA Guns, check out the amazing Hair Metal podcast, which is hosted by Kevin himself. So go and check that out. Also, check out Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, all on the Master Feed on the Podbean page. Be sure to email in any movies you'd like us to check out here on the show. And, of course, make sure they're big red and make sure they're good. I'm Adam O'Brien. We'll catch you next fortnight on here at Fandom Podcast Network's Lethal Mullet. G'day, mate. How you going? And I'll see you later.